Husserl assumes that when we look at the objects of consciousness, we'll find essences there. And G.E. Moore assumed that when we study what we know, we'll find that there is sense data. Now, who is right? Do we discover sense data or do we discover essences? Well, Husserl was quite convinced that he had gained clarity and therefore certainty about the nature of thought through his phenomenological analysis. Other people would say, I would tend to say, that phenomenologists end up finding in consciousness what they thought would be there. It's not that they found what was waiting to be found. They found what they expected given their antagonism to other methods and their new approach. That is to say, their language, their jargon, had implicit in it expectations about the nature of experience, just like G.E. Moore's did and everybody's does. We need to point out that Husserl, no more than Hegel, was able to complete this grandiose program of analyzing all experience and laying a foundation for all of the different sciences. Now, it is true that phenomenology has had an influence in developing a particular school of psychology, and phenomenology has had an effect in the study of sociology, distinguishing the experience of a social group from the structures of the social group and that sort of thing. So phenomenology has widened its influence, if you will, but Husserl never completed a task that could tell us what the full nature of reality is, a metaphysic, if you will, on which all the other sciences could be developed. In the end, phenomenology describes our experience. And you need to realize that even if the description is accurate, the description itself can never establish its own certainty. Let me say that again. Phenomenology sets out to describe experience. And even if the description is accurate, no description establishes its own certainty. You have the strange combination that Husserl felt that he had established something that's absolutely certain, a transcendental, if you will, a precondition for the intelligibility of experience, and yet he also maintained that all along his phenomenology was an improved empiricism. It was merely descriptive. Well, but you see, it can't be both at the same time. It can't be an empirical description and also setting down the preconditions of all description or experience. And then the final killer of a criticism is, when Husserl does his phenomenological reduction, and he reaches a transcendental ego that's the object of experience, when he reaches certain essences and so forth, the difficulty is not everybody who tries to practice this method comes up with the same conclusions that he did. That is, the transcendentally reduced observation did not disclose to everybody what was disclosed to Husserl. And Husserl said, in cases like that, they need to go back and do a more rigorous reduction. How could he be sure that their problem was that they had not been as rigorous in the use of this method as he had been? Now, I'm not saying that they're right and he's wrong. I just want to know, on what basis of reasoning did he conclude they are not being rigorous enough? How could he be sure in advance that if anybody did the phenomenological analysis in the way he taught it, that they would come to the conclusions he did? And as a matter of fact, even the most devout disciples of Husserl were not all prepared to follow him to his conclusions. Many of them felt that he had actually surrendered the quest for objectivity and ended up with what was something infected by subjective considerations. Particularly, as he said, there must be a transcendental ego, an I, which is the subject of all of these experiences. Do we ever experience the I of experience? Well, Husserl said, if you don't, you need to reduce more rigorously. Become a better archaeologist. Dig deeper. Well, if there is a transcendental I, then Husserl is thinking of something which, in a sense, constitutes the experiential world. If you don't have an I, a subject, then you don't have experience at all. And so some of his disciples eventually said, what really is the great difference between constituting the precondition of experience and constructing the experience, actually making it appear the way that it appears? To put it very simply, Husserl turns out either to be begging the question, just taking for granted that his way of doing it is right and what he's talking about makes sense, even though many people can't make sense out of it, and then he ends up being on the slippery slope toward Kant and Hegel, in that his transcendental ego, which he finds through phenomenological reduction, turns out to look like something that is constructing the nature of experience and not just being the object of the experience. Which is to say, very simply, for all of the grandeur of the program, and I've honored it previously in what I've said about it, I don't think phenomenology has been successful at all. So I'd like to make a transition from phenomenology to a school of thought that is not trying to save objectivity. Okay? Our first two considerations today, realism and phenomenology, were part of that 20th century desire to regain the possibility of knowledge of an objective world. But what we're going to look at now, existentialism, historically comes out of phenomenology, but it is not an attempt to reconstruct an objective knowledge of the world. We've said it over and over again, Husserl looked for clarity, for certainty in the use of our thinking. Cognitive certainty was on his mind. And so he thought of man as being a neutral observer, someone who could just be a spectator on reality. If he would just take the bias of his glasses off and look at things without presuppositions, if he just looked into pure consciousness, he could find the essence of reality. But many people have thought that Husserl's approach was far too intellectualistic. He was concentrating on the possibility of knowledge, but the existentialist despaired of knowledge and concentrated rather not on intellect, but how we should act. How should we live in a world that isn't rational, that in many ways seems absurd? Especially, how should man act in a world of absurdity when he knows he's going to die? And so though they shared a concern to analyze the subject of knowledge phenomenologically, these followers of Husserl moved in the direction more of Kierkegaard or John Dewey, where man's main project is to do rather than to know. They looked upon man, as they analyzed him, as an alien that's been cast into a hostile universe that doesn't have any purpose or meaning, and where he must choose to act in a certain way without direction. And that's the essence of the existential analysis of man's consciousness. Man has been cast into a world that has no direction or guidance, and yet he's got to make a decision how to live. So The first existentialist that we look at is Martin Heidegger, 1884 to 1976. Getting pretty close to our own generation. 1884 to 1976. He's a German philosopher who studied under Husserl at the University of Freiburg. And his main publication, Being and Time, was published in 1927 under the authorization of Husserl and Husserl's yearbook. And he dedicated the book to Husserl. But something must be said about the life of Heidegger so that you might evaluate him in full context. When Hitler took over, Heidegger had accepted the position of rector at the University of Freiburg. And in his inaugural address, he praised Hitler. And when Hitler started to practice his anti-Semitic policies, Heidegger, who could have protected his former mentor and the person who got him started academically, Husserl, did not speak a word in Husserl's behalf. He later said that he had come to reject the outlook of the Nazis. He retired and did a lot of writing and thinking up in the hills above the university. Was something of a recluse. But you can draw your own conclusions about the character, the moral character of Martin Heidegger. I've drawn mine. He wrote prolifically. The most important thing, as I said, is Being and Time, 1927. He wrote What is Metaphysics in 1929, Kant and the Problem of Metaphysics in the same year, On the Essence of Reason also in 1929. He wrote on poetry, Holderin and the Essence of Poetry in 1936. In 1943 he wrote a book entitled The Essence of Truth. In 1953, Introduction to Metaphysics. 1954, What is Thinking? 1955, On the Question of Being. 1956, What is Philosophy? 1957, Identity and Difference. You getting the point? Boy, he could churn the stuff out. Now, one has always got to be a little suspicious when you see somebody who writes that much so prolifically on topics which are deep, complex and difficult, whether he should have maybe spent more time thinking and less time writing. That's my own conclusion. But nevertheless, you should be aware of some of the titles and interest and the extent of his writings. Heidegger wants to do a phenomenology. He wants to look at our consciousness to find out the nature of reality. And the term that he uses for human existence is Dasein in German. Dasein. D-A-S-E-I-N. Dasein. Dasein means being there. Man is a being there. At one and the same time, this notion of Dasein shows the mystery of man's existence and the arbitrariness of man's being wherever he is. According to Heidegger, when man looks at his own experience, one of the things that grips him is the feeling of being hurled or thrust into the world. Okay, let's be sympathetic. Isn't he right? Haven't you ever said, why was I born when I was? Why am I in this area of the world? Why are things the way they are in my life? You didn't choose everything that's true about you. You didn't choose the color of your hair, whether you'd be male or female, whether you'd be Caucasian or black or Asian. You didn't choose where you were going to grow up or what things you would like. You were just hurled into the world, right? Dasein, you're just there. There's this arbitrariness about it, and yet there's a great mystery about your existence as well. Heidegger is particularly concerned to focus on the notion of freedom for Dasein. How do we as a being there come to enjoy freedom? Heidegger wants men to live authentically over against inauthentic existence. The inauthentic man is the man who accepts his Dasein, he's a being there, and relates to, if you will, the requirements of daily life in the way that anybody who follows the crowd would. He doesn't engage in creative discourse, he just engages in prattle. He's a man who's determined by objectivity rather than by subjectivity and freedom. He doesn't live authentically. He doesn't discover himself over against things as they are. He rather is defined by things as they are, by the crowd, as it were. Authenticity will only be possible for somebody who has come into the attitude of care, a translation for the German word Sorg, S-O-R-G-E. One must come to have a caring attitude. That English expression sounds too cutesy, but your attitude must be one of commitment, caring about things. You're not indifferent. You don't say, oh, well, what difference does it make? You know, do this, do that. Rather, you've got a sense of caring, of being committed. Now, if you're going to make a commitment and not just follow the crowd and be defined by objects as they are, then your life is going to be thrown into turmoil because you're going to have what he called angst, anxiety. Not angst like I'm going to the dentist, will this hurt? Anxiety about a particular thing that might be detrimental to you. But it's more generalized. It's about life in general. My very existence is characterized by angst, a foreboding, an anxiety. And once you are in the attitude of angst, realizing that everything's up for grabs, you discover your radical, finite nothingness. Well, if you weren't a nothing, if you were a something, then you wouldn't be free. If you were defined by other objects, defined by the crowd, defined by the nature of the world, then there wouldn't be any angst. You are just what you are. You're just the cog in the machine. But if you get beyond that, if you rise above that and realize the anxiety, the angst of life, then you are free to become something. When you realize that there's a nothingness about you, then whatever you are will be what? What you choose to become. And therefore, you will exercise your freedom. Then you'll be able to accept yourself as what he called a being toward death. Man is a being toward death. Hyphenate that. You're a being destined to die. And when you realize that you are destined to die, for the first time in your life, you'll realize what conscience is. Conscience will become the voice of sorg, of care. You'll be able to address your Dasein with authenticity now. And when you finally exert your freedom in a caring attitude, then Dasein will have been converted into existence. E-K-S-E-N-S. S-I-S-T-E-N-Z, existence. That grasp and reflects the nature of your essential finitude. You will become a true existence when you have finally come up and faced straight on your finitude. You are a being unto death. And now, recognizing the nothingness that is there, you will be able to make authentic choices and freely be what you will be. And so, that's Heidegger's way of explaining existence, existentialism. You will come to realize that you are a thrown into the world, Dasein. And recognizing your finitude, that you're a being unto death, then the voice of care will come and you'll be able to authentically exercise freedom. According to Heidegger, the basic philosophical question is, why is there anything at all and not rather nothing? And there's no way to answer that. I mean, why is there a world rather than no world? What can account for this world? What can account for our life in this world? And in the process, what existentialists like to do is to focus in very cutesy ways on the language of nothingness. All sorts of puns and, I think, slippery metaphors are used to talk about being and nothing, which, by the way, is the title of Jean-Paul Sartre's greatest work, Being and Nothing. Well, in the case of Heidegger, when we reflect on the nature of being, we have to take nothing into account as well. What is the nothing? Remember, as Hegel said, if all you can say is that something is, that's as good as saying nothing about it. But is it nothing or is it something? If you say something about it, that it's nothing, then it's something affirmative, but all you've said is that it's nothing. And so we get into these kind of little mind games about what nothingness is, what's the nature of nothingness. And perhaps the best known or the most renowned aphorism from Heidegger is the nothing nots. The nothing nots, or if you will, the nothing, not nothings itself. The negation negates itself. The nothing nots. Well, how can we find out the nature of being? What is the path by which Heidegger says being, and this is with a capital B now, not just individual beings, things that exist, but being in general. How does being over against nothing reveal itself to us? He said it's through the use of the word, through human discourse. In creative thinking and expression, the word becomes revelatory and discloses being to us. And according to Heidegger, this disclosure of being through the use of our language is better found in poetic expression rather than in rational expression. And so the conclusion is Heidegger is a mystic. We listen to human discourse, especially creative discourse, the way the poets speak, and there is something deep in them that reveals and discloses to us the general character of being. It's in poetry that I come to understand who I am and how I should live my life. Now, when I was introducing existentialism, I told you, you'll run into some vocabulary that's kind of bizarre. But I assured you that when you get past the strange vocabulary, as a philosophy of life, it's not that hard to understand at all. In fact, it's rather simplistic and puerile, intellectually speaking. Basically, he says, do a phenomenology of yourself. And what do you find? Well, you find all these fears and confusions inside. You realize you're a contingent being. You didn't choose where you were going to live and when you'd be born and what you'd be like and so on. You're just thrust into existence and you're finite. You're a being toward death. And when you realize that about yourself, then you'll start thinking life is too important to pass up. I mustn't be defined by objects and the crowd. I must assert my freedom and an attitude of care and commitment. Decide what I will be. And I'll best understand this nature of what being is if I listen to poetry. I get down deep and mystical into what the poets have to say, and I'll have a grasp of the nature of reality. Heidegger has been dismissed by some analytical philosophers as being involved in a pseudo-quest for profundity. What is man? Man is Dasein, being toward death. Man defines his being over against nothing, and nothing therefore enters into his... You start looking at stuff like that, and a lot of philosophers say, what is this? But just a bunch of nonsense. Just a bunch of pseudo-profound gibberish. I had a professor in graduate school. Not that I agree with him necessarily on this or other points, but just to illustrate this, he said, some people find it really profound to ask, why is there something rather than nothing? And others say, why even bother to ask that question? So it all depends on, you know, your perspective. And this is always the problem with mystical, ultimately mystical and subjective philosophies. In the end, you have no public claim on anybody. Anybody can come along and say, well, that's not my understanding of human reality, and I don't choose to be authentic in the way that you choose to be authentic. That is, being is not speaking to me in poetry the way you think it's speaking to you. Toodaloo. Now, as Christians, we wouldn't want someone to dismiss us in that way. What if we say, the Word is speaking, not the poets here, but the Word of God in Scripture. God's Son, the Word, speaks through the written Word to you and tells you about your finitude, tells you about your being unto death, and shows you how you should live your life if you would be saved. Now you see how I can parallel Heidegger's mystical existentialism to the Christian message. But now what if someone were to say to me, well, that's not the way things appear to me. You have your mystical insight, I have mine. You know? Your questions are not profound questions to me. They don't grip me. Now, can Christianity be dismissed that way? No, because what we say is we know objectively the truth about the world. We know where the world came from. We know where man came from. We know his character. We know why he has that inner alienation and fear and angst and so forth. And we know God's answer to it. And that answer is not subjective. It's not found in mystical experience. It's been declared to us in the gospel, in words. Now, people may say we're wrong. Many people say we're dead wrong. But the point is, Christianity cannot be dismissed as just, well, that's your mystical apprehension, and it's not mine. I don't even find your questions interesting, much less profound. But Heidegger, by contrast, presents, you know, this, what appears to be elaborate and almost contorted language, you know, trying to get out what being is and what human nature is all about. He's got his gospel. He's got his recommendation for how to live. But it's not objective. It's not public. It has no claim of truth on us. And so that's why we dismiss existentialism. Existentialism is its own worst enemy in terms of being a philosophy that makes a claim on people. The second existentialist that I want to tell you a little bit about is Jean-Paul Sartre. I don't like his philosophy, but I find it a lot more interesting, if you will, a lot more fun to play with this philosophy than with Heidegger's. Heidegger's is ponderous and ornate and so forth. Sartre, by the way, died just a few years ago, 1980. I believe. So, I mean, he's really part of the generation in which we are living. Sartre stated, and I quote, "Metaphysics is not a barren discussion of abstract notions which escape experience, but a living effort to embrace the whole of the human condition from inside." Once again, metaphysics is not a barren discussion of abstract notions which escape experience, but a living effort to embrace the whole of the human condition from inside. You see why he's connected to Husserl, phenomenology? Metaphysics will be a matter of grasping from inside, experientially, the human condition. This is what Heidegger was attempting to do. It's what Husserl, in a different way, a more rational or rationalistic way, was attempting to do. And this is what Sartre says we must do as well. Contemporary existentialism is fundamentally ethical in its origin and its motivation. It attempts to explore man's status in the universe and the implications that status has for how we behave. So existentialism is ethical in orientation. In that way, its 19th century parallel is going to be what philosopher? Help me, class. Which, that's right, Kierkegaard. Because Kierkegaard said it's not a matter of truth or grasping reality in rational categories, it's a matter of commitment. It's ethical in orientation. Sartre extols the virtues of authenticity and legitimate anguish, angst. He disdains the life of bad faith. These are terms you should recognize. Authenticity, angst, anguish, and bad faith, the attempt to escape from one's essential freedom.